the purpose of meditation, what it does for you. And it reminded me of another story. Thank you. Okay. Actually, if I leave any water in my glass, you should take it back as holy water. There was this very sick lady. She was half Thai, half Chinese. And she was so sick, was in a wheelchair, that she wanted some of this Buddhist blessed water, holy water. And I'm not always a kind man. I made it for her every week in a bucket. You know, as sort of, was it 2 gallon bucket, you know, to silver buckets. And I thought, well, she needs it, I'll give it to her. And week after week after week, I made her a bucket of holy water every weekend, and she took it back. And then one afternoon in the monastery where I live, I got a telephone call from a Chinese gentleman. He said, I want to buy some of Ajahn Brahm's holy water. I said, no, we don't sell it. He said, yes, you do. He said, from who? From that Thai lady. She'd take my holy water back, bottle it into smaller containers, and sell it. She was making a little fortune until she got busted. Very, very careful. And the Chinese went, very good holy water, very good. So anyone who's sick, if only really water, if you don't want it yourself, you can sell it on eBay. Anyway, back to, where was the guy? When meditation started to get well known in the West, anyone from Sweden here? Yeah. So your government, the Swedish government, wanted to find out what meditation was all about. So they got one of the professors from one of the big universities and paid him to do research. To go to Asia, to India, to Nepal, to Thailand, to Korea, Japan, and interview as many meditation masters as he could. And in order to make his research consistent, he had 4 questions he was going to ask every meditation teacher. So he could compare their answers. Standard questions, so he could compare the answers. And when he came to see my master Ajahn Chah, I happened to be there at the time. And because he was actually a representative from the Swedish government, Ajahn Chah gave him special attention. When it came down to the purpose of his visit, he said, through the translator, I've come here on behalf of my government to ask 4 questions from you. And I've asked these questions already of many great meditation masters in Burma, in places like Sri Lanka and India. And here are the questions. 4 questions. Number 1, what is meditation? Number 2, how do you meditate? Number 3, why do you meditate? And number 4, what do you get out of meditation? What benefits? And when Ajahn Chah heard those through the translator, he asked one of the novices, can you please give me a piece of paper and a pencil? And as soon as that happened, I knew Ajahn Chah was up to one of his tricks again. He was such a funny monk, totally unpredictable. And so, he scratched his head, he never does that. He was just playing around, acting the part. Okay. So, he wrote down the answers and gave it to the translator. And the translator, once he finished laughing, he translated it in English to the Swedish professor. My master's answer to your first question, what is meditation? His answer, professor, is this. What is eating? The answer to your second question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? His third question, how do you meditate? His answer is, how do you eat? And the third question, what do you get out of meditation? The answer is, you've guessed it, what do you get out of eating? And the professor, he was really upset and angry. I can't take that back to my government. But Ajahn Chah was stubborn, he said, that's all I'm giving you. That's a really great answer. I mean, what is meditation? Has anyone ever told you what is eating? It's a natural part of human life. You eat. And how do you eat? Has anyone told you how you eat? Maybe your parents, you know, told you, no, don't eat too much at the same time, don't speak when you're eating, all that sort of stuff. That's just etiquette. It's not even telling you how to eat. That's something that you know intuitively. And why do you eat? You all know that, because it's fun. You escape from suffering. No, you eat to keep healthy, obviously. That's why you meditate. To keep your mind healthy. Not your body healthy, your mind healthy. Food for the heart. Health food for the heart. Meditation. And lastly, what do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? Again, health and energy in order to serve in this world, to help others. Very brilliant answer. Instead of actually being philosophical, got right to the point with a nice simile. And that's why Ajahn Chah, sometimes his wisdom was woo, blew us away. So, for the person who asks, you know, what you get out of meditation, what you get out is the energy in your mind so you can serve and help others in this world. Without that meditation, without that energy, you're left with negativity, tiredness, which means you can't really contribute to other people, you can't really serve. So, there's also the other benefits, the health benefits. It cures people with cancer, with psoriasis, with heart disease, with Zika virus, with schizophrenia, with... It even brings the dead to life. At least, some of you were dead last night, excuse me. Anyway, I'm actually exaggerating there, but there's huge amounts of health benefits, and it also, people have shown by doing MRI scans on people's brain, your cortex grows when you meditate. You literally get more gigabytes between your ears. You're upgrading your hardware in your brain. You're doing that. It's been proven. Another thing which was proven, which was amazing, unexpected, that people who meditate, they stop aging. I think there is the mitochondria in the DNA. When the cells split, every time it splits and splits and splits, eventually the mitochondria wear out a little bit. They fray at the ends. That's the way these microbiologists were talking about it. They say when people meditate for 6 months, their mitochondria stay perfect. Not actually frayed. And the cause for aging had been stopped. So, if you want to remain as young as Ajahn Chah, what are you laughing at? And as young as Devon Chanda, do you know how old she is?
Was it
170? But she doesn't look like that, does she? Because she meditates. You do whole aging as well. And that's actually science, be proved. So you get so many benefits out of meditating. And also the best benefit, the benefit which I always say is the fundamental one, is you become peaceful and happy. You can let go of all those burdens and worries and problems and difficulties, which you don't need to keep worrying and being concerned about, and you can be free and happy. So, that's what you get out of meditation. So that's what I said when I first went to a Buddhist monk and decided to become a monk myself. I wanted to make sure this works. And I never ever wanted to be a student of a miserable monk. If they don't know how to be happy, they haven't learned the meditation themselves. And when I saw so many really great monks, the happiest people in my life, the happiest people I've ever seen were these monks. Now, hopefully, the happiest women I've ever seen the nuns. Is that true? You know, sometimes that really asks a very important question. How come when you don't take alcohol, you don't take any drugs, you don't have sex, You don't watch Harry Potter? How can you be so happy? I was a bit concerned this morning at breakfast. We were talking and laughing and joking around. And I'm sure the people in our hotel thought we'd been drinking. How else can you be happy like that? And it's because you're meditation. So the best benefit of meditation is you get happier and happier and happier. Real happiness. Not the fake stuff, but the really solid, delicious stuff. So that's what happens. That's why we meditate, to be happy. Okay. Venerable Chanda is going to auction this afternoon. The holy bell. Came last fall and it's been in my meditation center. I've had this in perfect form, now I'm having it now. So it's got all the power. But honestly, every now and again we're raising funds for some good purpose, we do these auctions. And in Hong Kong, my meditation cushion went for 30,000 US dollars. Amazing, it's got so much power in it. Ever since then, when I leave Perth to go stay to England, we take the meditation cushion and put it in a safe. Somebody decides to lick it. That's just a good cause and a bit of good fun. So this will be also later on for the Bigoodie project. And so you get a beautiful bear. And actually the bears are great for anyone who's ever depressed. Having a hard time, things are difficult in life, you lose your job, get dumped by your boyfriend or your girlfriend, things sort of, the biopsy turns out to be sort of negative. In other words, your cancer's getting worse. Hug a bear. And it's so beautiful. Right, straight away, endomorphins get secreted into your system. You don't feel so alone in the world. You've got a little bear to look after you. And it feels good. It's actually really nice. It is. How much is it going for? Can I have it for it? Okay. So you can stay here and do it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's private. It's got private. And I'll even sign it for you. For the success of it. On the back. I've got that joke, Mum. Okay, let's be serious now, like possibly can. Questions? Here we go. I've seen some more questions this morning because, you know, people take the effort to ask questions, I should ask them. Why are children born with severe disabilities or terminal illness like cancer? Is it all due to karma? Yes, but not as a punishment. Sometimes, to describe how karma works, if you've been really stingy in your past life, how better to learn generosity than be born and experience poverty? If you've gone without a meal, even for one day, you will never ever pass somebody else who's hungry, because you know how it feels. If you have been dumped, separated from the people you love, you know just how that sort of cuts your heart into pieces. So when somebody in your office, somebody you know, is going through that same pain, you can't ignore them. You can't say, I'm too busy. You'll take time to look after them. If you've been in great pain, and you find somebody else in great pain or sickness, you will volunteer to help them. Why? Because you know what it feels like. So sometimes being disabled, maybe it's where we need to learn what it means to be disabled and how to live with disability and how to get beyond disability. There's only part of you which is disabled. The rest is beautiful and perfect. Okay, I'm going to tell a story which I just heard this morning. The person knows who said this to me. Because I was coming from my little hotel to the other side of Russell Square. I told Sister Chandler, I'm with people all the time, talking too much. I'm just going to have a quiet walk by myself. And it was working okay for half the journey. And then someone came running behind me, Etabam, Etabam, Etabam. And then another few minutes, another man came up, Etabam, Etabam, Etabam. I cannot be alone. But they were just saying just how some of these teachings really help. They're apparently born with, was it macular dystrophy or something? Something where their eye, the centre of the eye cannot see properly, only the periphery. And they were just so upset about that when they were young. They wouldn't be a doctor, but they couldn't. But they said them my teachings, you know, just because someone like them is a schizophrenic. There's a person. No schizophrenia. There's no criminals in the world. There's people who've done crimes. Look at the upper parts of you. Look at the upper parts of your facial field, which isn't affecting. And so she did that, and you know about that. And one day, on the underground, she was sitting there, minding her business, because you're not allowed to say anything on the underground. Except if you're on the underground. I'm talking to people on the underground. Say, hi, how are you? Where are you from? I'm from Australia. And because I look weird, they don't mind me doing weird stuff. It's really good fun. Being in the underground. But anyway, no one's talking to one another, and she saw this man. He had a backpack on, moved the backpack to the front, and try and grab somebody else's bag while they weren't looking. What a thief. And because she saw that, she shouted out, I wouldn't do that if I was you. And the man ran off. She saved this woman's back from being stolen. And everybody, or a couple of people, looked at her and said, good eyes. And she said, that really sort of affected her. Because she didn't have good eyes. But the good part of the eyes which she did have, she used well. Now that's how we deal with disabilities. They're not really disabilities. That is a tiny bit. Whenever you go and visit someone in hospital, for goodness sake, never say, how are you today? That's the most stupid question in the whole world. They're sick. That's why they're in the hospital, stupid. If they were feeling well, they wouldn't be there, would they? So never talk to the illness, talk to the person in the hospital. Talk exactly the same sort of stuff when you were having a cup of coffee with them, or having a cup of tea. Talk about football, the politics, your life, the latest gossip, jokes, anything. Because let the doctors and nurses talk about the sickness. You talk to the other part of the person. And that really helps them so much. So, why should we warn with these things? Basically, because on my terminal illness, we call them shooting stars. For me, I often tell people that when a person dies, even if they're a child or a sort of 103-year-old man, it's not important your age, not the quantity of life and the quality of your life. In those 2 or 3 years you've been on this planet, what have you done? How much love and inspiration have you given to your parents? That is what's more important than the length of life, the quality of it. It doesn't really matter. If someone has a terminal illness, like a cancer as a kid, a lot of times they've got, you know, I see this often, they've got so much life force inside them, little kids. They've just come into this planet, just been born. And they can, that life force can do stuff which, you know, middle-aged people just cannot. They can bust that cancer so easily because they're so alive, so much force inside of them, life force. Which is one of the reasons why young people, they usually survive the cancer. But if they don't, and they do die for whatever purpose, why is that happening? And the answer is the little story told to me when I was a young monk by an old monk who was living in the north of Thailand. And he said, once living in the north of Thailand, in the jungles, in a bamboo hut with a thatch roof, there was a huge storm. The storms are part of nature. This was a big one, the rain was lashing down, the winds were very strong, branches were coming off the trees, and then whole trees were coming down. And he was scared of his wife. There was only a bamboo thatch hut in the middle of the jungle. One big branch, or even a tree, fell on his hut, it would go straight through, And if it didn't kill him, it would disable him. No, obviously, iPhones. A long way, many miles from the nearest settlement. It was a waste of time, he would die. Injury was probably worse than death, because the death would take longer. So, he was really scared. Meditating all night, sort of meditating, and suddenly, crash! Boom! If ever you have to give a presentation or a talk at a school or university in front of your business, please do a few boom! Crash! Because people go to sleep all the time. This wakes them up. So they're listening again. So anyway, boom, crash. But it always just missed his heart. In the morning he got up, you know what it was like, see the damage. He was lucky. A few branches and trees that only just missed his heart. But what took his attention was the leaves which had been torn off the trees and lay dead on the forest floor. Most of those leaves were old brown leaves who lived a long, long life on the tree. But amongst those brown leaves were many yellow leaves, middle-aged leaves, and some green leaves as well. And some leaves which were just that very fresh green colour, which meant they'd only probably been on the tree for a few hours, probably only shot forth that day, and now they too have been torn off the tree of life and lay dead on the floor. And then he got what we call insight. He looked up to see what leaves were left. I should expect mostly green leaves. But even though young green leaves lay dead, there were still quite a few old curly brown leaves still hanging on to the tree. They hadn't come down yet. He said, that's life. Even though young people, children, babies die, still some old people, your grandma, your great grandpa, they still keep hanging on. Is there something wrong with that? Said, no, this is nature. When a storm comes through a forest, it mostly takes the old leaves. It always takes a few young leaves, and very young leaves too. When the storms of death come through our community, it mostly takes the old people, but also takes some middle-aged young, and even very young people as well. Falling leaves. Nature. That's the truth of our life. Whether it's bees in the jungle, or human beings. So when a kid dies young, there's nothing wrong with it. This is life. And anyone who says, oh, that's not unfair, they haven't had much chance in prison, I mean, human life. Don't worry, I'll have another go on, because so they all come back again and get a second chance. So, anyway, that's answering one question. There's a lot to go. Then another question. So, don't hear anything. Okay. We will see what happens. How we can find contentment and motivation to develop ourselves, knowing that our siblings or people we love stay in the same place, they don't want to be anything, or they don't have enough power or wisdom. Going further without others is pointless. You always drag other people with you, whether they like it or not. Just the fact they're around you affects them. But one of our presidents in Perth, really every week coming to our temple, he's a really amazing man. He was a person who does regressions in Perth, takes people to their past lives and checks them out, they're real. And so his first wife, got cancer. She would never come to the temple. She wasn't interested in Buddhism or spirituality, but you know, she's a very loving wife. And when she got cancer, terminal cancer, and on her deathbed, this Buddhist was amazed at how much Dhamma she'd absorbed without ever going to the temple or reading a book or seeing anyone on YouTube. She absorbed it all just from him. That was her husband. And he'd taken these teachings And it was part of his life, part of his character, he was starting to live them. And that's what she saw and heard. And that's how she grew. Never come into a temple at all. And that's the same with the people you know, even the people in your workplace. The very fact of who you are affects other people much deeper than you'd expect. So the fact that you're a good person, a kind person, a forgiving person, a happy person, that affects people around you. You may not realize that, but it affects them very deeply. So unfortunately, you do drag people with you. It is just nature of things. So if you are creating more contentment and peace and happiness and joy, you're creating so much happiness and peace and joy amongst everybody you meet. That's the way it works. This is the next one. Totally by chance, I don't know what to do. Can you say something about the difference between welcoming and attachment, please? Very easy. When you welcome something, you let it come in. When you don't let it go out, that's called attachment. Your mind has two doors. And I say opening the door of your heart. Remember, when you open the door, things can go out as well. I don't mind, I had got a cold, I just drank too much tea this morning, and my level of the water is liquid, it's so great, it's just During this morning's meditation, I was kind to the nagging pain, this must be yesterday, nagging pain in my neck and shoulders, and tried to relax, the pain did not go away, my focus on it seemed to be more worse than trying to ignore it. The physical pain is about the emotional pain of caring for someone I love who is an alcoholic. I care as much as I can, but don't know how to accept, get past the pain, and care to find the peace beyond. This is possible. It is all possible, but if you are trying to relax the pain to get rid of it, that doesn't work. Oh. If you're trying to relax the pain to get rid of it, it doesn't work. If you're trying to let go so it disappears, it doesn't work. You have to really let it go. Or rather, let it be and let all the control go. It's a difficult thing to do. Once you do that, you get the feedback. If it gets worse, you're not really doing the letting go. You have compassion. You're trying to get rid of it. So sometimes people say, we try this, it doesn't work. I open the door of my heart to the pain. I'm going to let it be, let it be. Why haven't you gone yet? That's not letting it be, that's doing your business there. I let it be, it's not letting it disappear. It's not letting it be. So when you do it, really let it go. Really let it go. It's really incredible. My first experience, I wrote about it, Tuesday, really bad Tuesday, in the jungles, no telephones, even landlines, no sort of mobile phones. Many years ago, no electricity, no place to go, no medicine in the cabinet, no aspirin, Panadol, paracetamol, nothing. Really, one monastery. They just had to bear, enjoy it. It was really unenjoyable. Tried everything I knew to try and get rid of it, and then only at the last said, okay, I give up trying to get rid of you, I'm going to let you be. And I really meant letting you be. You can stay with me for the rest of my life. Pain. You can even get worse if you want to. I'm not going to try and control you anymore. And honestly, that was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. You know, just one moment I was in agony, really just not knowing what you're going to do next. You know, crazy with pain. The next moment, this up. It was changes. 1 second. As soon as I let it go, no pain, so much joy and freedom. I've heard letting go, letting go, letting go many times. Because I was desperate, I had to. And I did. And from that time on, I'm not really afraid of pain. And if it really gets bad, the mind will kick in and let it go. And no worries at all. Absolute peace and freedom. Amazing. So please, I hope, when we're at this, I hope your pain gets worse. So next time you can really let go and piss out. Now, I don't know if it gets worse because that's really cruel. But eventually, you do the letting go. The person then goes up and the pain vanishes. Well, the Buddha said, two parts of the pain, the mental part and the physical part. The physical part will always be there. The mental part is 95% of it. So the mental part, which we can't take, once the mental part goes, then everything else goes. Yes, absolutely. Oh, the tea. That's very good. Okay, I think maybe that's enough for that one. More. I've experienced just pain, joint pains, for almost 10 years. Taking joints is against the law. Marijuana is illegal. It's also against the because they're joints. Is that what it says? I've experienced joint pains for almost 10 years. There's no diagnosis and it goes on after taking painkillers. The pain happens almost every week. Pain is often hard to resist. I mentioned this to people just before I came in here. A lady in Eastern Europe sent me an email this year. It says it to our secretary of town. She showed it to me. Almost made me cry. This elderly woman, I think it was in Poland, and listened to my talks on YouTube, had arthritis in her joints. And that is incredibly painful. And she was taking medications, strong painkillers. They weren't working that well, many side effects. And she had no choice. That's the only way she could get through the day. Day at a time, hour at a time, it was excruciating pain. And when again you're desperate, you go on seeking anything. She managed to hit my website or the YouTube channel, followed my advice on the meditation, which I've given you here. And she wrote this beautiful email saying, thank you. I don't need to take any more painkillers because I've got no more arthritis. Totally gone. And I thought, wow, that's the only thing I've ever done in my whole life. Taught someone so they could have their life back again. Out of the torture chamber of arthritis, that my life has been worthwhile. When you help someone like that, you can imagine just how it really goes into your heart and really sort of gives you so much joy and humility as well that you can actually do something like that. Wow, that's better than winning. That's better than winning a medal at the Olympic Games when somebody writes something like that to you. But most importantly, she showed it can be done. Possible. This type of meditation is being done in hospitals with people with chronic pains. It does work. You've got to be really mindful, aware of that pain, and then add the kindness bit to it. So it relaxes. Little by little, 0.001% at a time. And then you keep on going and going. Once you learn the trick, you notice, yes, the pain is getting better, it is getting better, it is getting better, it is getting better, you can feel it. You just carry on until it just totally vanishes. Sap it away. It's powerful. I told you about my food poisoning the other day. And it surprises me. When I did that, I thought, wow, this meditation is really good. Even though I've been doing it for years, I still get so impressed and inspired. When actually, what I teach on is you practice yourself. And my goodness, it works. Imagine you had that skill. Any pain in the body, you don't need the painkillers, you don't need sort of the injections. You can use your mind and relax it totally away. Wow, what a gift that could be for people. So, very simple. The problem is that too many people use too much force. Concentrate, try and force. That is not what works. Beautiful relaxation, softness. My first encounter with this type of method, 6 or 7 year old boy in Acton, Creswick Road, playing soccer in the street. or in the asphalt. Every now and again you go for a tackle and you scrape the skin off your knees. I recall my childhood always having scabs on my knees from playing soccer. And that was part of life. But when I did scrape the skin off my knees, I'd run to my mother, crying. And he said to her, "Mummy, Mummy, I'm bleeding." And Mummy would kneel down and kiss my knee. She called it kissing it better, and it worked every time. Immediately she did that, all the pain went. And she put a band-aid on it, she never cleaned it, put a band-aid on it, and it always got healthy. Even though now I really wonder how this works. A mouthful of germs on an open wound. Never ever does it. Now the love of a mother, the kindness, that is incredible power. And that heals so much. And I thought that was natural, that was normal, I didn't know anything about science. And mother sort of kissed the wound and pain went completely away. And then, band-aid, a plaster, that's the price. On your knee, and then you're out playing football the next minute. You kid, you love playing. So that was something I just remembered from the past. And thought, wow, how can I do that with the wounds and injuries in my body? The pain. Kissing it better. Mother is dead now, but I can still kiss it better. So that's actually what I do if I get a pain in the body. I look at it and give it real kindness. As if I was my mum and kissing it. And it goes. So that's a marvellous way of dealing with pain. This beautiful kindness. And if you don't know what kindness is, have a bit for this teddy bear. So it's got so much kindness in it. So you can do it. It's incredible that this can be done. And I feel a bit sad that this is not taught more widely. There's too many people suffering in agony. Painkillers, a lot of them work, sometimes they don't. Even those they work, sometimes have very bad side effects. Next question, do Buddhist monks and nuns have to live separately from each other? It's a good question, the answer is yes. Because people are always suspicious. And to know what I mean, I've already mentioned my mother, now my father. One of my father's favourite jokes, and this was way before I became a monk, wasn't even a Buddhist yet. He would come home from work and he would say, "What fun does a monk have?" Answer, none. That is absolutely not true. In either way, I have a lot of fun, and it's not with nuns. But people are always suspicious like that. Especially when you don't know what monks are, what nuns are, and what real Buddhists are. And so because of that, we have to be squeaky clean. Not only sort of keeping our precepts, but seem to be keeping our rules. Otherwise, it's so hard to prove you didn't do anything. So people actually say, they allow suspicion to actually prove you didn't have sex. You can't prove you didn't do things. You can only prove you did do something. And so because of that, people have suspicion. People are like that, you know. You know, when I did that thing about ordaining bhikkhunis, I had to be very, very careful. Because as many people wanted to destroy me, literally, and so be very careful, there's no possibility of anyone doubting your purity. There's nothing which... I remember seeing this poor monk, I knew he was Ajahn Chah's secretary. It was too much work, so he just ran off into the jungle and meditated. And he eventually became the teacher of the Prime Minister Thaksin in Thailand. And you know all the red shirts and yellow shirts controversy. Taksin was supporting some of the poor people, and people wanted to bring him down. One of the ways of bringing him down was bringing his teacher down. I remember seeing this in Thai newspapers. A woman was going in to his kuti, and then Phil shot her coming out again. The implication is this is Mark's mistress. And it was just totally wrong, because he wasn't going into his bedroom, it was like going into the complex where he'd receive guests and do his business. It wasn't his bedroom, but that was the implication. And he ended up running away, disappearing, because he didn't want to have any more stuff to do with the newspapers. And they actually effectively destroyed him just by innuendo. So I have to be very careful, especially when I become a famous monk, to make sure that, you know, enemies, you always have enemies, everyone does, even the Buddha had. So I always have to make sure that you are pure and seen to be pure. And because I knew that, when I did the Vicuna ordination, I know there's no cracks, there's no way that people could somehow sort of pull me down because I wasn't good with my precepts. Yes? In which case, I did Vicuna ordination or just being celibate? Vicuna ordination. So when I came here, I came just before Vicuna ordination, actually to inform Ajahn Sumedho I was doing it a couple of weeks beforehand. I wasn't keeping a secret. I wanted to tell him personally. And I also met one of my old schoolmates, actually university mates. I remember talking to him, I said, this is what I'm going to do. And he said, there's not many monks that can actually do this. There's not many monks who are strong enough. Now you have to really be internally strong to be able to take, you know, the criticism, to know that this is what you need to do. That takes strength. And I always like telling people this. One of the key moments of this for me was went off to my home monastery, Wat Pa Khong, and they wanted to investigate this. 3 hours it was going on. And after 3 hours of talking backwards and forwards, a lot of rubbish being spoken, then came the crunch point. They said, Ajahn Brahm, you can stay in this community with all your friends. These are my friends I've grown up with for almost 30 years, and people you love and care for. Now we have history together. He said, you can stay as normal if you admit that those 4 nuns are not real beginners. But if you maintain the real beginners, then you're out. We kick you out. And it was an important decision. And I remember just how difficult it sometimes is. Sometimes to take the easy way out, no problems, no suffering, or to do what's right. And it's one of those things in your life. You have this choice. I will never criticize anybody who takes the easy way out. You may think that they're weak, but at the time, it takes an enormous amount of courage to stand your ground, knowing there will be very difficult consequences. But you know what I thought? I thought, when I die, I'm going to remember this moment. And if I don't do the right thing now, I'll regret it forever. And so I don't care how much it's going to hurt. Those are bikinis. You can do whatever you want. And I'll never regret that moment. It was tough. Honestly, you may think it's easy, but when you're right in the middle of that situation, it's so easy to take the easy way, the safe way. But you just can't do that. That's my upbringing. My parents, my father, everybody. That's how I was taught, and that's how I felt. So that's what I did. Don't praise me. Praise all the people who taught me and encouraged me. Because I'm teaching and encouraging you. Never ever take the easy way. Take the right way. Even if it costs you your life. So anyway, that's serious stuff. That's not jokes. So anyway. Let's get some easy questions now. How can a person like Andrew Kimbala, who murdered 999 people, obtain enlightenment? If he could, surely you can. Is there anyone here who has killed 999 people? One person? And sometimes people ask that. How can I get enlightened? You know, I'm just an ordinary person. And I put this up here, Andrew Kimbala. That guy, he became enlightened. There's people who stories of him. One of my heroes when I first went to Thailand, he was the dumbest person I've ever heard about. You know, really mega dumb. Because in Thailand, you used to have, everyone had 4 years of school, minimum. If you came from a good family, you can go on further. But this fellow from the village, 1 year in grade one, and his teacher couldn't pass him. He had to repeat the year. Now I know we can repeat, you know, the A levels and O levels, but grade one? I can't, what did he fail? Plasticine? But anyway, he had to do another year in grade one. All his friends went up. 2 years in grade one, still hadn't got it. Had to repeat it third time. And after 3 years of trying to pass grade one, with the best will in the world, his teacher failed him a third time. So that was it, out of school. Hadn't even passed grade one. So the parents thought, what can you do with a kid who can't, after 3 years, can't even pass grade one? So in Thailand, there's only one option, the monastery. That's what they do. It's too stupid to pull a plough and work in the fields. So they sent him to the monastery, and this was a city monastery, village monastery. And you know, sometimes the people can criticize those village monasteries for not, you know, keeping the rules, for having TVs and money, but there's some really, really, really kind people in there. So, you know, their kindness, they are a little bit indulgent, but they're just so kind. And so this elderly monk really looked after this little kid, trying to spend hours teaching him chanting. Just like basic Buddhist chanting, Namo Tassa. He got the Namo, and then he had to start with Tassa. And then what was the first one again? And he really was, you know, a case. And after a couple of years of trying to teach his kid basic Buddhist chanting in the village monastery, even the abbot got fed up. So there's only one other place for him. The forest monastery is where I come from. Now, this is not my biography. Not all forest monks and nuns are stupid. But this guy, you know, he weren't focusing on study, just on meditation. So the teacher there just gave him simple teachings on watch your breath. And this guy, he had such a simple, peaceful mind. He could watch his breath all day without missing one. He got incredible meditation, became an arahant, fully enlightened, and one of the famous ones in Thailand. And the only way he could ever chant, he couldn't learn anything in his life. The only way he could actually do any chanting, he used his power of his mind to go back into a previous life when he could chant. So when he had to do any ceremonies, call the previous life, bring the chanting back and chant in. That's how he did it. He made the mess weird, but that's actually how he explained it. But Darius was the most stupid guy I've ever known. Academically, became a saint. So if you think you're stupid, you have great potential. What is it saying? Everybody can. Just about. Everybody. So how did Andrew Kimbala do that? What did the Buddha teach him? Stop. You learn how to stop. Really stop and be still. Which is a great segue into one of my favourite stories. I'm going to get them used on another one. It's the donkey and the cow story. This is an original Martin Brown, because these metaphors, you can always make up new metaphors, don't always use the ones which the Buddha used. Can you understand what's going on? Get a metaphor for it, and it brings the teachings alive, and it really helps you. These metaphors, you understand what you're doing wrong, and how to do it correctly, get enlightened. You know, donkeys, the most stubborn animals in the whole world. You can get a stick and beat the donkey, and the donkey won't move. That's not how you use the stick. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck, at the front of the stick, about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head, you tie a string, and on the end of the string, a carrot. So there you are, the donkey sees a carrot 2 foot in front of him. The donkey is stubborn, it won't sort of move because of pain, but it will move because of desire. Put a carrot there, the donkey goes towards it. As the donkey goes towards the carrot, the stick moves, and the carrot moves. So the carrot is always 2 foot or just about in front of the donkey's mouth as it pulls the cart for days and days and days. The donkey can see the carrot, can smell it, it's almost there, but goes towards it and moves away. Do you recognize that phenomenon in your life? Perfect relationship, you can just see it, you can see it there. You just go towards it and it goes. You know, the perfect day, the perfect partner, the perfect job, the perfect house, the perfect whatever. You can actually see it, it's there, you smell it. But you just can't grab it, keep it. Happiness. But one day the donkey reads, was it Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond by Ajahn Brahm, where the donkey learns how to catch carrots. So easy. I want you to know. So the donkey has been running after that carrot all its life. Running after it, it's always 2 foot in front. But then the donkey hears the incredible words. Stop. Donkey. Stop. And the donkey stops. Like Andrew's mother did. And what happens to the carrot? As soon as it stops, the carrot swings further away. Have faith, have patience. When I say let go, sometimes your mind goes all over the place. Stay letting go, have a bit of faith and patience. Until that carrot is 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Never been so far away before. Sometimes people complain, yeah, I do this letting go business and my mind is wandering all over the place. You know, I've never been so restless before. Wait. Carry on letting go. Because the time comes, 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, and now the carrot starts to come towards the donkey. Soon it's only 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, the usual position, but now it's coming at full speed towards the donkey's mouth. And it comes right to the donkey's mouth, stopping on the last bit of Dharma to become enlightened. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open. Compassion. And that's how donkeys catch carrots. And so it's going up the mental stop, swings back in the mouth, got your carrot. That's you as well. With everyone in life, you've been chasing too much, stop. It goes away from you, swings back, and then it comes to you. That's what meditation is. Running after meditation, you stop, be still, your mind goes haywire, and then it starts coming towards you. Another jhana. Three meaning. The other three attainments. Psychic powers. Whatever else you want. Stop. Stop running after things. And things come towards you. Okay, another couple of questions. So we're just in meditation. Dear Ajahn, you make attaining the limitless sound so easy. It is easy. You make it difficult. We are not fortunate to have your you to train and teach us. What do you mean? I'm teaching you now. You are so fortunate already. And some people say, oh, what's going to happen when I leave? It doesn't matter. I've already got into your head. I'm inside already. You've got no choice anymore. It's too late for you. How can we attain this place here? Do we require strict guidance? No strict. The whole idea of strict, not compassion at all. It's not sort of adjusting the teaching for every individual, trying to push everyone into a box. There's no other person that might do this whole class. Listen. So please, respect your uniqueness. Be at peace with yourself. Stop trying to change yourself. Instead, open the door of your heart to yourself. Be at peace with yourself. Then you're still. Then all these things happen. Peace and compassion. Which is so easy, but somewhere, someone says there's something wrong with you. I don't know who that was. It's total bullshit. You be you. Be at peace with yourself. Be still. And all these incredible things just come to you. So because you're trying to improve yourself and change yourself, you think you're becoming enlightened, it's improving yourself. It's not, it's being at peace with yourself. No more craving, no more desire, no more ill will. No more measuring who's good, who's bad. No more of that. Peace, stillness, freedom. So easy. Do we require strict guidance? No. Or can this be attached by solitary retreats? Yes. They will be. And there we've got anyway. They're just, everything disappears. And you're not in the sort of state. Must we stay in the retreat to attain? No. Can it be done if we are working full time? Yes. Can you recommend a teacher in London? Yes, your heart. This is your teacher. So easy. But if you need any guidance in London, well, maybe to attract more nuns, we need a place for nuns. Otherwise, had a lot of people inviting me to Ireland on this retreat. And if you don't get the place for Sister Chanda here, maybe Dobby might catch her first. We always go to the high school, don't we? Sorry, I'm a bit cheeky. I feel good when I wear expensive, well-made, good quality clothes. Yes, just like me. This is a design alone, made by Gucci. Yes, right? It's just a muscle. I know I hold my head higher, look people in the eyes and smile more. I know I give out more positive energy and I get it back and plenty of smiles from other people. Is it justified to spend lots of money on my appearance when I see that it produces more happiness in me and around me? Also, is wearing makeup okay if it produces the same effect? I don't wear makeup. Actually, I did twice. The first time I wore makeup, I had to go on the TV. Now, eight of you. That's actually one of the other great things in my CV. That over in Perth, I really go out of my way to make friends with other religions. And the dean of the cathedral in Perth, he's a really good mate. So he invited me to give the sermon at a Christian Eucharist. And he knows it's Christianity. This was the first time in history, 2,000 years, that a non-Christian had given a sermon at a full Christian Sunday service. So proud. That's another rebel tick point. Breaking the mould in Christianity, give a Buddhist monk giving a service at a Eucharist. So, that was big enough news that I got invited to be interviewed on the morning news. So I went to the station together with your son, Ajahn Brahmani, Alf, and I'll never ever forgive him for this. You can actually remind him of this. Because they said I had to go into makeup. before you go into the studio because the bike hurts. I've never been to makeup before. I'm a man. Really embarrassing. And so there I was sitting in a chair, makeup. And Ajahn Brahmani, one of my right hand monks, that's Elf and Liz, son, Christina's brother, he was making faces at me all the time, embarrassingly like hell. I don't know where he got that from. Oh, that was really embarrassing. But that's just what you have to do. So I wore makeup before. Those under the TV studios. So, is it judged by spend lots of money on those things? But if it does really make you happy, fine, you earn the money, so you can spend it on your happiness. But the Buddha said, don't spend all your money on your happiness. He said, keep some of it back for the lady day. This is the Buddha teaching, Buddhist economics. Spend some on your family to make sure your partner, your children, other members of the family are okay. And the other, you know, portion, spend for charity, for the community, for society. So, yes, you know, you make the money, enjoy it, eat your favourite foods, go on holidays. If it seems like clothes make you happy, fine. But you don't need to wear expensive clothes to impress people. The best makeup in the world, the thing which makes you most attractive, is your smile. I get photographed a lot, not because I wear fashionable clothes. Or makeup, or have a fashionable hairdo. It is quite fashionable these days. Because of a smile and happiness. That is the best makeup in the world. But yeah, you can if you want to, but share it out. Okay, that's the last question. Have you ever had any nightmares as a monk? If yet, what's happening in your dream? You know the answer to this one. I don't make this story, well, some monks can make up, but this one I don't. This is absolutely true. I did have nightmares in my first 3 or 4 days after I ordained in Bangkok. I'd wake up in the night, sweating, feeling really anxious. And this is no exaggeration, my nightmare was that I was a lay person. I think I was a layman still. And I'd wake up and I'd see my robes next to me on the floor. I'm a monk, I've made it. And I close my eyes and go into a really deep sleep. Then that was psychologically how much I wanted to be a monk. It was very, very deep inside, much deeper than I knew. I love this lifestyle. And even after a few days, I realized I'm in this for life. Other people said, how long did you become a monk? You were the last. But I was... No one thought I was the master, because I was happy. And I thought, you have to be suffering to be a monk. And no, I'm having a good time. I love this life, it gives me immense personal happiness. Immense. And number two, I'm now in a position I can give that happiness to others. It's such a privilege to be able to see you guys and girls and have you come and say thank you. You really meant a lot. That is big happiness. So I'm really way up there in job satisfaction. So that's the only nightmares I've had. That's a very clean young man. Weird, isn't it? That's only one for you. Last question, you have 3 last questions. This is synchronicity. This question is, how could a person who had murdered 999 people become alive? Repeated. It's incredible. When I do these question and answers, there's always some questions that are repeated, and you never hear them again for years. So maybe just how you start to synchronize in your minds. That you have a question, and another person has the same question. Totally unrelated people, who are actually tapping into one another's thoughts. What is this? Best part of the day for meditation, how does meditation relate to Buddhism and Nirvana? First of all, the worst time to meditate. The worst time to meditate is later. The best time to meditate is now. this is a wonderful answer, a very deep. And how does meditation relate to Buddhism and Nirvana? Buddhism invented meditation. We were the guys who started it. And now, especially jhanas. Some people say the Hindus started beforehand. No, they did not. It was the Buddhists who started all of this. He was the guy who brought it into the world. And without that meditation, there is no Nirvana. If you can't be still here and now, stay really still when you die. You won't be able to get to Nirvana. So meditation is awakening to Nirvana. That is taught by the Buddha again and again and again. Okay, the third last question. I've got two more, four. Just came out, it's meant to be. Breathing in peace, breathe out cancer. Is it not a distortion of reality? Are you wishful thinking? It is wishful thinking, but that's how we create reality. This is physics, theoretical physics. Reality is not something out there which you suddenly discover. It doesn't exist without you. We create our reality. That is quantum physics, the Schrodinger equation, Copenhagen interpretation. We create the future. Choose which of the possibilities in the smear of probabilities described by the Schrodinger equation. Our observation, choice, is what creates our reality. You don't realize how much power you have to create a future. And maybe out there in the world, so many other people creating stuff, it's difficult for you to influence, but in your own body, in your own mind, you have immense power, which you just do not know how to use. You can look at people who use hypnosis. So easy. This standard experiment, which has been talked about a lot, had a nail, 4-inch nail on the end of a piece of wood. Hypnotized this guy into believing the nail was red hot. It was just a nail in temperature. And they touched it on his arm. Ah! He screamed. He thought he was being burnt. That is understandable, belief. But that belief created a blister on his skin. A real blister as if that was hot. How on earth can that happen when that nail was just room temperature? The mind created that blister. Shows the mind can affect the body. If a mind can create blisters, it can disentangle and uncreate tumors. If you know how to do it. Your mind is incredibly powerful. It's one of the reasons why I was taught as a school teacher, we got a GP in because it's only a matter of time that some kids, not kids are like playful, in the chemistry laboratory, they'll spill a big tumbler of concentrated acid over them. They put their fingers in the electricity sockets. There's many dangerous stuff in the laboratory. Sooner or later, a kid's going to hurt himself. As their teacher, we have to know some basic first aid. So we got this GP in. Really nice, old GP. Now we've been there and done that. And he told us he actually got a lid, a white cloth, and I think a thimble full of blood. And he threw the thimble full of blood onto the white cloth, and it went everywhere. And he said, look, it's only a tiny bit of blood. But it spreads so fast that you see blood everywhere. Don't worry, there's plenty left in the body. Because he said, maybe doctors might disagree with this, it's over 40 years ago now. He said, if ever you see one of your kids, you know, his hand is dangling off, he's got burns all over him, whatever, the last thing you should do is make him feel afraid. Ooh, that's terrible! Just you must break your precepts and lie. Say, oh, that's nothing. You'll be okay. Because fear always makes the pain worse. People go into shock and they die from the shock. He said, the mind kills more people than the injuries do. That's on the TV. So it's true, because when you go to shock, your blood vessels, what they dilate or something, and then you get a heart attack or whatever, yeah, something like that, but the shock actually kills people. I always say that, reassure them. You know, their head's hanging off on one side. Doesn't matter, you just put it back on again, and just reassure them, oh, that's enough, there, you'll be fine. You'll put that back on again. Fear kills people. The mind is very, very powerful. So when I say breathing in peace or health, breathe out your tumour. It works. You've got to believe it. Obviously, if you doubt, ah, this is rubbish, it's not going to work. Of course it doesn't work. If you believe it's not going to work, you make it not work. And you've got to visualise that health. Visualize a tumor. It doesn't matter how you visualize it, it doesn't need to be accurate according to anatomy. But when you do that, and you really get into it, your mind is creating your future reality. That's Buddhism. Mindful and all things. I must admit, this is where Buddhism shines above others. It always makes the mind prominent. Not stuff, not beginning of the world, or anything like that. It's about your mind. That is where the happiness and the power lies. And that's what we do in meditation, training that mind, really getting it strong. Okay, the third last question.
Six.
I can't count. There are three types of people in this world, sister. Those who can count and those who can't. What is the role of a mantric meditation? Okay, the mantra can get you focused, makes it interesting, such as, you know, breathing in peace, breathing out, cancer, whatever. It gets you into the breath. Instead of breathing in, breathing out, in, out, in, out, it's not as engaging. So, in Thailand, I used to use the mantra, Buddho, Buddho, breathing in, Buddho, breathing out, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. Tried that, but you have to be like a born Buddhist to really understand that word and for it to have power over you. So in the West, I use another mantra. It's actually quite effective. When you breathe in, say to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut. Shut. It gets to the heart of the problems. It just annoys me. Shut up, you've got to say. Okay, I think that is enough for now. I'm going to shut up. Good segue. So let's have a bottom mouth break and then come back and actually, so let's be meditating with you. Should we do some meditation? It's a good idea, isn't it? Okay, I'll shut up. Okay, bottom mouth break, back to the front of meditation.